This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Our guest today is Dr. Benjamin Shestakovsky, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Shestakovsky is author of Behind the Startup, How Venture Capital Shapes Work, Innovation, and Inequality, which was published this year by the University of California Press. An expert in the effects of digital technology on work, employment, organizations, and social change, he's won awards from two ASA sections for this work. Today on the Annex, stark inequalities within a tech startup, venture capitalism, and the promise of a windfall cash out for some. Our conversation was recorded on Wednesday, August 7th. Stay with us. Well, Dr. Benjamin Shestakovsky, welcome to the Annex. So good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Well, I really enjoyed reading this book. I don't spend a lot of time in the work and organizations literature. So what's great about the podcast is that I read outside of my little niche areas. And we are living in a world where tech startups and the digital economy and finance are huge, huge topics. So I want to ask this question to start, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but are you rich? You held a key role and were one of the earliest employees at the company you call Alldone. Many listeners have heard of startups that are eventually valued in the billions of dollars. So are you fabulously wealthy? And if not, why not? What features distinguish your work from those other Alldone teams, like the folks in the Philippines and Las Vegas?
Dan, I'm disappointed to say I'm not rich.
Bummer.
But this company did go on to be valued at a number in the billions of dollars, over $3 billion. I guess I can step back a little and talk a little bit about my position and how it came to be. So I started this research as a grad student when I was interested in studying startups. I had offered to work for this company as an unpaid intern in exchange for research access. And they talked about it and they agreed to let me do that. And that role quickly evolved into first a part-time paid position. And then pretty quickly, it was a small startup at the time. I think when I got there, there were 8 full-time employees. And the CEO asked me basically if I would consider leaving grad school for a while to come on full-time. And I, discussed it with my committee. And actually at that point, I didn't even know if I had a committee, but my advisors, and we decided, this was kind of a golden opportunity for data collection. So over at Alldone, they created a new position for me. And I did work full-time at this company for a year. Part of being a full-time employee at an early stage tech startup like this was receiving a small stock option grant. It would fully vest over 4 years. So since I was there for a year, I think a quarter of my grant vested. Now on paper, as I explain in the book, that stock option grant is now worth $200,000, which is certainly a hefty sum. But of course, you can only sell stock options if there's an event where someone agrees to buy them. And at the end of the book, I tell a story about sort of the last round of VC funding at this company, where basically the way these deals are structured is every round of investment, new investors come in and they offer to buy equity in the company for a certain price, some of which is equity that other people already own. But the way the deals are structured is that the people at the top of the chain, like the previous investors, the founders, they sort of put themselves first in line. And then by the time it gets down to, for instance, previous employees, in this case, there was really previous employees were only allowed to sell a tiny fraction of their stock options. Anyway, all this is to say that it's paper money. It may never be worth anything to most of the people who hold it. That is part of the story here. Now, when I'm talking about most of the people who hold it, well, as I mentioned, I was doing research in the San Francisco office of the startup, but there were actually 2 other teams of workers, and they were all working from home, kind of distributed remotely. 200 people in the Philippines doing sort of behind the scenes, highly routinized information processing work. and 10 people in the Las Vegas area who were basically answering the phones, doing customer support for users of the software, of the platform. So those two remote teams offsite, work from home contractors, first of all, they weren't even full-time employees, so they did not receive stock options or any of the other, you know, health insurance benefits or other benefits associated with full-time employment. But they also constituted 92% of the company's workforce. This sort of starts to give you an idea of some of the inequalities in the typical venture-backed firm. Now, I don't know if this 92% figure is typical, but I do know that even at large tech companies like Microsoft and Google, you know, there's been reporting to suggest that over half of their workforces are contract workers that are not full-time employees and do not receive things like stock options and benefits. So really, you know, we're starting to see a story of how the tremendous wealth generated by technological innovation really tends to be funneled into a very small number of hands.
So the employees at Google don't all have access to that awesome building with the slides and the free lunches and the beers after, well, really any time, but, you know, early into late evenings and the parties and things. I mean, I was struck in your book by how much of the action takes place, not necessarily like in the workday, but happens after the workday when the organization in San Francisco are the recruiting new programmers, or they're hanging, you and others are hanging out at the office, you know, 8, 9 o'clock, maybe later at night, just, you know, continuing to work, but also continuing to think about and imagine futures for the company and its in its efforts to seek more funding and more growth.
Exactly. Yeah. So part of the set of perks that employees received was that there was a chef in the office. The office actually had a kitchen that was sort of in the center. So people could come in and make themselves breakfast, but then a chef was preparing lunch. And then she would leave dinner, you know, in the fridge for people to get later. People really did, just like at Google, right? And other tech companies that have these kinds of perks. It was very common for people to stick around, have dinner, keep working, but then sort of the working also blurs into socializing. And a lot of the socializing and the talk ends up having to do with what could happen to this company. What could it be? I use this term to describe the organizational culture in the San Francisco office called a culture of speculative optimism. So people are sort of watching as they are continually experimenting with the platform, trying to get the numbers to go up. And as the numbers do go up, obviously, this is very exciting for someone who holds stock options in the company, right? Whose own wealth is tied to the valuation of the company. And so, yes, there's a lot of talk both during the workday and sort of especially after, when people are kind of lounging around, having a beer as they're doing some work and chatting with people. A lot of conversation about what could this mean? If this project I'm working on works out, what could that mean for the user numbers going up? What could that mean for the company's valuation? And then ultimately, you know, how does that get us closer to an IPO where we all become fabulously wealthy?
Maybe one day for you, Benjamin, maybe one day. I want to make clear for people, just because we haven't mentioned this explicitly. So All Done is a company that matches local service providers with people who need those services. And by services, we're talking about anything from lawn care, painting, guitar lessons, I mean, I don't know, roofing services, mm-hmm. basically just any kind of thing that you might have previously found in the Yellow Pages if you needed a dog groomer or a pet sitter or just any kind of like human service thing. All Done is trying to match those providers with people who need those services, and not just in one place like you might find in the Yellow Pages for Philadelphia, but really anywhere in the United States. And I mean, I guess presumably one could imagine a company like this branching out to other nations as well. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about All Done. And in addition to speculative optimism, which is heavily featured in the first early parts of the book, of course, as you develop this story, you also have several other concepts like valuation lag, technical lag, trust drag, and more. So for those of us who don't know much about the process of seeking and securing venture capital funding, how do each of these concepts work for different groups in that process?
Yeah, so, you know, startups that are seeking venture capital funding, it works in sort of a cyclical fashion where a company goes out, tries to raise money, raises the money, pours that money into the company, into maybe growing the team that's building the company and also, various projects. And then, you know, tries to show that the company now is more valuable than it was before, and that the next investor should pay significantly greater sum of money to purchase a stake, the same kind of, you know, stake in the company. And really, the way that VC works is that VCs invest in a, you know, substantial portfolio of startups. They do so with the understanding that almost all of those startups are going to fail, which means either like the company will die or it will survive, but it will become what's known as a zombie, where it's really, you know, it may be sustainable, right? It may be making enough money to pay the bills. It may even be slightly profitable, but it's not showing massive growth trajectory that will display to future investors that this company is more valuable than it used to be. And it's going to be far more valuable when it's your turn to sell your stake in the company. And so that's really the name of the game for a VC-backed startup. It's less to turn an operating profit and more to increase the perceived valuation of the company, right? What someone is willing to pay for it. And someone's going to be willing to pay more for the company generally if you're able to show that you're growing it really fast across whatever the key metrics are for your product, whether that's like the number of users that you have, the amount of revenue you're taking in, different sorts of activities that users are engaging in. If you can show that stuff is skyrocketing, then you have a good chance of convincing investors that the valuation of the company is increasing dramatically. And so this idea of valuation lag, this is a problem that really any venture-backed startup has to deal with. This is my way of saying that when investors put money into a startup, they are doing so with the understanding that, you know, hopefully down the line, they'll be able to sell their stake for much more. The valuation needs to go up. But there is sort of this temporal and imaginative gap between the state of the startup at the time that the VC invests in it and the state that they believe or hope that it will be in when they're able to sell. And so it's up to, in the case of this book, the software developers in the San Francisco office at Aldun to address this valuation lag, to constantly be doing things that they believe will hopefully get the numbers to go up and thus get the valuation of the company to increase. So they're constantly just experimenting with the platform with all sorts of different features. Small things like, what if we change the color of this button from red to green? Would that increase the number of people who click on it? Oh, it turns out we ran an experiment and 14% more clicks came through on the new version. So let's change it all to the new version, right? And so you start adding up all these small experiments with some big experiments as well, like I talk about in the book, maybe we'll talk about later, like changing the actual business model in a sense, the way that people pay to use the product. And you add all that up and then, you know, hopefully you're starting to see some big numbers adding up and future investors getting really excited about buying a stake in this thing because it seems like it's going up fast and it's only going to keep growing. Now, that impetus from investors to constantly be experimenting and changing the product in order to grow really fast, that creates other organizational problems. The problems that I observed at Aldun, I gave the names technical drag, trust drag, and I believe managerial drag. No, was it organizational drag? Can't remember. It's been a few months. Any case, it's either.
I wish I had the book here. It's back in my office.
Yeah. It might be organizational drag. But anyway, so the idea of technical drag is that, okay, It's your job to be growing this platform really fast. But actually, sometimes there are things that software engineers alone, they can't really do themselves, whether it's because of limitations of the technology, because they just don't have enough engineers on staff to take care of everything they want to do, or because it's just turns out it's just faster to use humans to do a job than it is to use software alone. And so this technical drag was addressed by hiring up this team in the Philippines. Folks making on average about $2 an hour to do this sort of highly routinized information processing work. If listeners are familiar with Amazon's Mechanical Turk platform, it's this kind of stuff, what's often called click work, you know, making kind of receiving some sort of input from a system, making some sort of quick human judgment and transforming it into some sort of output. And one of the examples I give in the book is that this process of matching buyers and sellers on the platform was actually only partially performed through the software. And in fact, the software sort of moved it along a little bit, but actually what it did was it presented workers in the Philippines with a list of potential matches from the all-done database. And then the workers would actually have to click on the matches that they judged would be good matches. And this is something that eventually was automated, but when all-done only had like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 engineers on staff, they were so focused on getting the numbers up that they did not want to spend their time on this sort of like basic infrastructure. So they delegated that to, at one point, almost 100 workers in the Philippines. That's technical drag.
I want to stop you there because this was one of the most fascinating parts of the book for me, was that essentially, and I just want to highlight this, essentially the very core of the function that's promised by all-done as a website platform thing, a tech company, is not done by the tech, the non-human parts of the system, like the algorithm or whatever kind of matching process would happen inside the box of the system. It's done by people who are an ocean away from the continent where these requests are actually being generated and where the services are actually being provided. It's kind of incredible, right? That the very core, like the promised core of the technology is 100 people, eventually like almost 200 people doing these kinds of tasks in the Philippines. It's like, yeah. It's wild. It's wild, Benjamin, wild.
Yeah. So Janet Vertesi at Princeton and some of her colleagues wrote a really interesting article a couple of years ago about this concept of pre-automation. In a sense, this is sort of what was happening here. Like, eventually, the plan was to code this thing up, as I'm sure users of the platform believed that this was being handled by AI, right? And eventually, that would happen. But there was a long period of time, really spanning years, when, as you said, this really core, the purpose really of the platform was actually being handled by human workers, by a massive, as the platform grew, they had to keep growing and growing this team. It's an example of what some folks have called artificial intelligence, right? So if artificial intelligence is about simulating human cognition, then a process like this is sort of about simulating a simulation of human cognition, right? Humans pretending to be software, pretending to be humans. And this is not a phenomenon that is exclusive to all-done by any means. Really, there's a lot of great scholarship that has developed over the last decade on machine learning algorithms and AI more generally, which it has a very nebulous definition, but there's a lot of scholarship that makes it very clear that none of the AI-assisted products and apps that we use would really be possible without these humans in the loop, whether it's people, you know, labeling images or annotating data, people screening out the inappropriate, horrible, harmful, violent content from social media sites and platforms. You know, there's all sorts of functions that are going on. People, even Google, right? Google's famed search algorithms. Well, those are search results actually get rated by human workers, often outsourced to places like the Philippines. And then those ratings get fed back into the algorithms to help inform what we see as end users. So this is really just part of the picture when it comes to AI development, but it's a part of the picture that is typically hidden from end users. We usually are not told, you know, that there are humans in the loop making decisions, and of course, often being paid surprisingly low amounts of money by these massively profitable tech companies, as you know, to make the products that we use possible.
Yeah, super fascinating that the lowest paid employees, which are sort of like not, they're outsourced, right? They have a weird relationship with All Done as an entity, right? They're not employees in the way that the San Francisco office employees are. And, you know, but yet they are doing this like fundamental function of the product.
Yeah, it's not, it's sort of somewhere, what All Done did was sort of somewhere between, you know, having a workforce of these remote teams in the Philippines and Las Vegas. It's sort of somewhere between full-time employee and Amazon's MTurk. People were being hired as long-term contractors through another digital labor platform. So this is a company that is a digital labor platform. It's creating a digital labor platform to connect buyers and sellers of services in the US, but then it relies on this digital online freelancing platform. At the time it was called Odesk, now it's called Upwork, to basically recruit and hire and supervise these workers in the Philippines and Las Vegas. Usually this platform is used for sort of like short-term freelancing projects, but they were sort of repurposing it to build these long-term virtual teams of contractors who they called team members, rhetorically sort of framed them as organizational insiders, but who ultimately were just making an hourly wage without any of the, you know, employment protections or benefits that full-time employees are eligible for.
All right, let's talk about TrustDrag and organizational.
Yeah. So again, I was talking about sort of how does this impetus to constantly be experimenting and growing the company create other kinds of organizational problems that at All Done were often solved with low wage labor. So I talked about technical drag and the workers in the Philippines. Another issue I call trust drag. Also, I should mention the reason I use this language of drag is because in the startup world, the metaphor of the rocket ship looms large, right? You want to be fueling this thing and you want to just be launching skyward and just increasing its valuation up to the heavens. So everyone talks about this thing like it's a rocket ship. And so the idea of these drags is that they're kind of forces that pull that rocket ship down, that threaten to slow its acceleration, slow its growth, and that they then have to overcome to keep the rocket ship on its trajectory. So trust drag is a phrase that I use to talk about simply situations where users don't necessarily accept what the company is proposing to do. When there are issues where users' trust is, you know, called into question or betrayed, where they feel like, oh, this platform is not necessarily something that I can rely on. And actually, I may be quite upset about something that's happening here. So, you know, the way they address basically the feelings that users have as this platform is sort of constantly transforming under their feet is that they hire these workers in the Las Vegas area, again, work from home contractors, to be phone support workers and to sort of get out there on the front lines and talk to users who, you know, either are confused about what's going on with the platform, who might be really upset about what's going on with the platform, who are having trouble succeeding on the platform and are blaming the company for their lack of success. I should mention that sellers of services, you know, like your plumbers and house cleaners and wedding photographers and things like that, they had to pay All Done to get in touch with the potential buyers. So a buyer comes in, they say what they're looking for and where they are looking for it. And then that gets sent out to sellers, and then sellers have to pay Aldun to get in touch with that buyer and sort of pitch their services. And so it was the sellers who were usually the most upset because they're paying good money to get in touch with buyers, but they may not be, you know, getting the jobs that they were led to believe or that they believed they would get. So these workers in Las Vegas would get on the phone with folks. Sometimes it was simply about sort of educating them, right? Like, people are confused. This product is sort of designed to like funnel as many users in as possible, which usually means you don't explain all the details up front. There's a lot of confusion. One of the things that the phone support workers in Vegas did was just kind of help people learn how to use this product and hopefully get better outcomes with it. Sometimes people really felt that their trust in the platform was and the company was betrayed, and the phone support workers would kind of have to get on the phone and try to talk them down, or as they often said, like, they would call it turning them around, like trying to take people who are really angry. Maybe I just spent $75 to respond to five customers. I got no jobs. I just threw all this money at your platform and I got nothing. And I'm upset, you know? And so they would get on the phone with someone, try and explain to them, you know, maybe there are these other things you could do to have more success. Oh, when you try to get jobs in person, you don't always get all the jobs that you go out for, right? It's the same thing here. You know, just trying to kind of calm them down and help to keep them engaged with the platform, even when they were upset about their outcomes. And then the last thing I talk about that they did was, you know, when big changes are coming in the platform, like a change to the pricing structure, to the fee structure, to how much these sellers would have to pay to use the platform. The company kind of tried to get out in front of it by having all these phone support agents call thousands of sellers and basically tell them ahead of time, hey, listen, we're going to be changing the fee structure. They didn't exactly say it, but the sellers figured out pretty quickly, you're going to have to pay a lot more to use the exact same product in the same way you have before. And so it was up to these phone support workers to kind of, you know, try and keep people calm and try and convince them, even though you might think this isn't really working out in your favor, you should still stick with us. You should still, you know, stay with the platform and give it a try, give this new fee structure a try. So that's sort of trust drag. That's how, again, how these workers in Las Vegas were sort of thrown at this problem of keeping users engaged with this ever-changing platform. I'll just briefly mention this organizational drag, which is that as a startup matures, as it advances through rounds of VC funding, the way that it's organized has to change. At first, you know, small startups are supposed to be nimble, adaptable. You know, one person might wear a lot of different hats. Everyone knows what's going on in the organization because it's so small. Everyone, you know, at least in the San Francisco office, would have had sort of a voice in what's going on. But as the company grows and more money starts flowing in from more and more wealthy investors, well, they want to see this company professionalize, right? They want to see the division of labor expand. They want to see people, experts coming in from the outside, right? People who have backgrounds in management consulting and people who have backgrounds in C-suite executives in the past at tech companies. And basically, this is just a time when sort of the structure of the organization has to change in order for the company to keep going on its quest to keep boosting its valuation and keep attracting new investors as it matures. And I talk about the different ways that sort of impacts the different workers in the organization, right? And how there were some differences across San Francisco, Philippines, and Las Vegas. But overall, one thing that was consistent was sort of a disenchantment, which is kind of, you know, any scholar of organizations or reader of Weber would probably be familiar with this idea that, yeah, as bureaucratization increases, it starts to feel less like, oh, it's this thing that I own, that I'm a part of, that means so much to me. And it starts to feel more like this thing that we've built that now has taken on a power of its own and is sort of demanding things of us. It's no longer something that we control. It's controlling us. And I think that at least is something that was sort of consistent across the whole workforce.
That's great. Yes. The Weber reference is strong in this one. Have you tell the story of Will, and it's related to Trust Drag and how the platform changes over time. And of course, this is one of the big strengths of your book, because you were in the field for quite a long time. This product is changing. The people who are working on it, the team is growing, you know, as more rounds of funding come out and are acquired. And then the priorities of the company change through each round of funding as well, to keep at the start, to grow users, and then to turn those users into actually profit generating clients of the company, service users of the company. All that to say, on page 219, you tell the story of Will, a web designer who gave guitar lessons on the side via the web using Alldone's platform. So can you tell us about Will, his engagement with Alldone, and how his work changed when Alldone's terms of service changed in order to make the company more attractive to or the next round of VC funders?
So just like a piece of brief background that goes back to what you just mentioned, right? At first, Alldone really wants to bring lots of users into the platform. That's their strategy for raising their first round of VC funding, is like proof of concept. Do people want to use this thing? So they do that by offering this subscription model to sellers, where they pay a flat monthly fee and they get to respond to as many buyer requests as they want. Obviously, this is something sellers really like, and this is something that this guy, Will, who I will tell you about, was taking advantage of. Like you said, he was a web designer. His wife was an aspiring actress. They lived in LA. And he, at some point, discovers Alldone. And he's also, on the side, he's in a band and he's played guitar for a long time. And he discovers Alldone and he thinks, oh, this could actually be really fun. Like, what if I just start a profile here and I use it to try and get some clients for guitar lessons, just as like a side thing for him that he thought he would really like, because he has such a passion for guitar and for music. So he starts a profile on Alldone and he actually starts to get a few clients, and it builds slowly but surely. And, you know, some people drop off, but then some new people come in. And at some point he starts to realize, like, hey, I have sort of enough of a thing here, enough of a business here, that if I just keep going with this and growing my guitar teaching business, then I could actually quit my web design business and just do this, which he just really loved to do. He liked to do it more than web design. And so he kind of like cooked up a business plan to convince his wife that this was okay. And he went for it. And soon after, Carol, who was the head of the Las Vegas phone support team, she called him and she told him about basically what I had said before. The fee structure was changing, and the instead of paying on this subscription model where you could pay one flat fee to respond to as many customer inquiries as he wanted, now he was actually going to have to pay to contact each customer individually. And so his costs, you know, for acquiring customers were about to skyrocket. He wasn't told this, but this happened because Alldone had sort of transitioned from trying to grow its user base to trying to prove to the next round of investors that they could monetize this user base. That's sort of the term of art in the field, right? Show not just that you have users, but that you can make money off your users. You don't necessarily have to be profitable, but like show us some revenue growth here. And so that's why they decided they have to get rid of the subscription model and start charging sellers for each contact with a buyer. And Will is, you know, he had sort of gamed this all out and priced this all out according to one set of rules, right? Only to find that the rug was being pulled out from under him, and just kind of suddenly, arbitrarily, the company was telling him, those aren't the rules anymore. Now you have to play by this new set of rules. And, you know, he was really he was really upset about this, understandably. I was getting updates from Carol on a daily basis about her conversations with Will. And at one point I told Alden's product manager in the San Francisco office the story about what was going on with Will and how I felt really bad about it. And he basically told me, don't feel bad about it. You know, he's gotten good business out of Alden, and if he doesn't like it anymore, he can leave, right? But I think what that perspective misses is sort of just how much people, you know, they come to rely on these platforms. They come to make plans around them, build futures around them. We saw the same thing with Uber. There's this pretty infamous story of an Uber driver. I believe his name was Fauzi Kamel. He had a dash cam in his Uber. He drove in San Francisco. And one day he picks up Travis Kalanick, who was the co-founder of Uber and at the time was still CEO. This was before he was ousted. And, you know, they start a conversation that is cordial at first, but after a while, the driver says, like, listen, like, I went bankrupt because of you. I hope I'm not misquoting him, but something like that. Like, you know, Uber had been paying drivers at a certain rate, especially if they had, you know, purchased a new late model vehicle that was a very nice vehicle. But then they introduced these kind of like Uber X, the lower cost pricing structure that sort of undercut all those folks who had invested in more expensive vehicles. They decreased the rates that they're paying everyone. And, you know, he's basically telling off Travis Kalanick and saying, like, you basically lied to us. You undermined our businesses. I'm bankrupt because of you. So, you know, it's the same sort of thing where startups are sort of constantly experimenting, offering some kinds of features or some kinds of terms that then eventually, as they grow, they may suddenly decide that they have to change. And the sellers or the users who, you know, sort of made plans around how this system worked, they're the ones who really get left holding the bag. And, you know, I think that example is probably more dramatic than Will's example, but they're both cases where someone's life and livelihood was really kind of turned upside down by sort of the continual experimentation that is part and parcel of this VC-backed funding model.
All of this, of course, is happening in a political and economic context in which our public policy leaders are often celebrating tech entrepreneurship and really clearing the way for these kinds of, I mean, we call them innovations, that kind of has a positive connotation. But in this case, doing so in an environment where there are very few safeguards or guardrails in terms of regulation that would make the lives of Uber drivers or Lyft drivers or people who try to sell services through Alden's platform, you know, give them some kind of security and stability for their operations. And as you say, their livelihoods.
You know, I'm not against innovation. And I think a lot of people who might identify as tech industry critics would say the same thing. Innovation is fantastic. There's so many products and services that have come out of Silicon Valley that we really enjoy using that we wouldn't want to give up, right? There's no doubt about that. At the same time, there's just tremendous amounts of wealth being created through these products. It's generally a very small number of people who are capturing a lion's share of that wealth, where in a lot of cases, for instance, I was saying VC investors, they might invest in 10 companies and they will assume that 9 out of 10 are going to fail, right? Their portfolio is diversified. But like an Uber driver or someone like Will, they don't really have the opportunity to diversify their risk portfolios in the same way. Mm-hmm. And what you see in the case of, for instance, Uber, something that I cite in the book, is that when Uber did IPO, the top 5 equity holders in Uber, which was, I think, the 2 co-founders and then 3 investment funds, took home $27 billion. Okay. Their equity is worth $27 billion at the time of the IPO. And at the same time, due to driver protests, Uber offered bonuses to drivers who met a certain threshold for, you know, the number of rides they'd completed. And that ended up averaging $273 bonus per driver, right? So it's really almost as if they'd gotten a tip of a few pennies on each of the rides they had completed. So again, you see like there's this massive upside that's being captured by a very small number of people at the top of the chain, a massive amount of risk being taken on by the people at the bottom who can't necessarily afford to be taking a lot of risks. So yeah, I do think that, I mean, we can talk more about policy, but I do think that, you know, tech companies have certainly taken advantage of a regulatory environment where in a lot of places they're able to classify workers as independent contractors when, if you look at sort of the IRS criteria, they're clearly, it's not clear that they're independent contractors. You could argue just as easily that they're full-time employees as you could that they're independent contractors. So, you know, that's been certainly an issue that's been the subject of a lot of activism and litigation. We're sort of seeing in the Biden administration action on tech monopolies that sort of wasn't taken over the previous decade, two decades of the development of the tech sector. There's a lot about our policy environment that has sort of enabled VCs to capture huge amounts of wealth when the companies they're funding succeed, and also that enable these tech companies to recruit and in many cases, you know, arguably exploit low-wage workers to do all the things that allow those massive profits to be generated.
I want to focus in on one of those lower wage labor forces for a second. You know, your time at All Done, you moved from an internship to part-time to then a full-time position. And as part of that work, you supervised All Done's Las Vegas customer service team. And as we've talked about, these workers weren't directly employed by All Done. But I want to focus here on what was it like for you to be in this role, to be in charge of this team, and to try to convince company leadership to make good change that would make these workers' lives better. I mean, you mentioned Carol, the customer service lead in Las Vegas, and Carol and their team had to make these thousands of calls to All Done's clients, basically. I mean, they're the ones who are paying at least to use the platform, users. And really, I mean, dealing with irate people, doing a lot of, you know, what we call emotional labor, right? Pulling out the mark, you could might put it that way if you had a particular frame on this, right? So what was it like for you to be in charge of that team that wasn't directly employed by All Done, but also so reliant on All Done for their livelihood as you try to convince company leadership to make good change?
I mean, it was very strange, awkward, uncomfortable experience, as I think other ethnographers who have kind of found themselves, in my case, really just sort of stumbling into a position of relative power in this organization. It was not my plan going into things, but it's sort of how things evolved. So yeah, I ended up basically, I guess I would say sort of like overseeing this customer support team in Las Vegas. It was really run on a day-to-day basis by Carol, who is the local team leader. But I was the person who was in the San Francisco office, who was sort of taking strategic direction from my supervisor, who was a co-founder of the company. And then, you know, sort of transmitting directions and those tasks to the team in Las Vegas. And It certainly put me in a position where I felt hugely uncomfortable, not only because, you know, I'd certainly never planned to or wanted to inhabit a position of power in this organization, but of course, there I am. You know, I think I was like a 29-year-old white male at the time who was supervising this team of mostly middle-aged women in the Las Vegas area, like just these huge, you know, gaps in the lives that we had led, in the privilege that I had versus the lives that they were leading, making $10 an hour as independent contractors for All Done. And so, you know, I did feel a responsibility to do what I could to try and minimize the difficulties that they faced. I mean, on the one hand, I want to be clear that, you know, by sort of inhabiting this position of relative power in the organization, there's sort of no getting around the fact that I was in some ways complicit with what, you know, you might argue was the domination or the exploitation of low-wage workers who were there to create value for this company and for investors. So I, by staying in this role, even if I was trying to make things better for this team, which I was still a part of that process. And you can't really get away from that. But I did try to do things that would make their work lives easier and make their lives easier too. So the things that I tried to do that would cost the company something, I were repeatedly shot down. So, I mean, one of them was when this new payment model went into effect and the executives in San Francisco wanted these 10 people in Las Vegas to call thousands of sellers and sort of absorb their abuse and their anger and try and convince them to stay with the platform. You know, the early experimental calls on this were just brutal, totally brutal. And I expressed my concerns to leadership in San Francisco and they, you know, I'm not going to say they were unsympathetic, but they sort of felt like, well, this has to be done. If the workers don't like it, they can leave. Mm-hmm. And actually, the fact that the calls were so brutal to them were a sign of how important they were, right? They were a sign of how our software alone, sending out mass emails, like there's nothing we can do as software developers to make this work for users. We really need this human touch. So actually me trying to tell them like these calls are brutal, I don't think we should be subjecting people to this, actually, I think sort of solidified their resolve to have humans do this work. I also, when all done, raised a second round of funding. I talk about this in, I think, chapter 7. I was advocating repeatedly to my supervisor that folks in Las Vegas get a wage increase because basically they had been told by Carol, the team leader, for a long time that like all done didn't have a lot of money, but once things got better, they could make more than $10 an hour. It's sort of a longer story than what I have time to tell here, but that just wasn't, my boss was not really hearing it and he didn't want to increase the wages. It did end up happening, but only after I had announced that I was leaving to go back to grad school and they hired my replacement. And then she kind of saw the same thing that I saw. And she, I think, was taken more seriously than I was. But yeah, those kinds of things where it would cost the company something to make a change to improve things for the workers generally were not accepted. The main thing that I proposed that was accepted was basically me taking on more work. I said, listen, the folks in Vegas and the Philippines, users are kind of coming to them and saying they're having problems with things that are, you know, experiments or changes with the platform that they don't even know exist because we never told them. And so I said, I will write every week, I will write a product update and send it to the folks in Philippines and Las Vegas. And I will detail for everyone what the hell is going on so that then when they're dealing with customers, they will know what people are talking about and hopefully have an easier time helping people. So that was something I was able to accomplish. But again, it was something that cost me, you know, time, but it didn't cost the company anything. And so that may be why that particular change was accepted.
It's good that you mentioned Carol's work with their team and the idea that, you know, early startups, they're bootstrapping things, they're trying to be as efficient as possible. And so, yeah, $10 an hour now and increases as the company builds. And of course, if you're a leader of the company, like those are your costs. Like those people are, you know, cutting into your bottom line and also making it harder to convince future funders that you have a sustainable revenue model moving forward. I wonder if your replacement, Benjamin, was one of these like more professionalized people. So a similar process is happening kind of like at Carol's level and at your level as things change that when your predecessor comes on, that person has more like official credentials in, say, human resources or management or whatever. And what we haven't mentioned so far is that the Las Vegas team actually is eventually closed, and that work has transitioned to a different place in Salt Lake City, actually. But all of these are events are oriented around the desires of venture capital funders at various stages of development in the company.
Yeah, absolutely. So, right. So my replacement coming in, that was part of that transition I talked about in terms of, I think, organizational drag. You know, as I was leaving, the second round of funding had sort of just arrived. And my replacement had experience as a management consultant. She also had experience running, you know, what's often known as people operations for another startup. And so, yes, I think that my boss was inclined to defer to her because she, you know, had this professional background that really none of us had when I was there, right? It was all just people who kind of, one of the terms that was used was often opportunistic hires. You know, it's like, oh, I know someone, he's smart. I trust him. Like, let's bring him on. You know, people with like law degrees who are running marketing. It was just people who knew people and, you know, these sort of network hires. Obviously, there's a lot of homogeneity that comes with that. And that's a big problem in the tech industry as well. But yeah, that's definitely part of this story. And I guess one thing that I would also add to it, to that story about sort of $10 an hour now, but in the future, there will be more as Aldun grows, is that, you know, we often hear about how, and I certainly write about how sort of these more privileged elite workers in the main offices who are full-time employees who have stock options, how they're sort of enrolled in these imaginary futures and companies try to get them really excited about cashing out because, of course, that will supposedly make them work harder and work longer. Getting them invested and giving them an ownership stake, you know, will ultimately benefit the company's growth. But what was interesting about this case was that, you know, folks in Las Vegas often expressed things that even though they didn't hold stock options, it made it clear to me that they were also sort of enrolled in this imaginary of being in on the ground floor of something. And as you mentioned, within a year after I left the field, the entire team was closed, was terminated. But they still had this idea, which may have been partially fostered by, you know, what they were hearing from leadership, this idea that, you know, they were there at the start of something that could get really big. And they sort of, even though they didn't have stock options, it was clear that there was still this idea that was very much alive that, you know, they were going to be riding this wave too, or they were going to be riding this rocket ship. Again, you know, it comes back to this story of, you know, well, it turns out 92% of the workforce was not riding the rocket ship along with everyone else. And in fact, this team in Las Vegas ended up being viewed as totally expendable. They had done the most important thing, really, executives said, in the company's history, was this transition away from the subscription model into the pay per, you know, contact model that I talked about earlier. And there's no way to do that without this team in Las Vegas. But once they had done that, they weren't really needed in the same way anymore. And they were viewed as expendable. And then, as you mentioned, another team that was more professionalized in Salt Lake City was brought in instead. So it sort of plays into this whole story of sort of, again, who rides the rocket ship and then how actually the vast majority of the workforce is sort of left behind on the launch pad, sort of watching it ascend without them.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, to continue the metaphor, like the builders and maintainers of the rocket ship and the processes that launch that ship and keep it in the air, so to speak, aren't even employed with the company and are locked out of any ultimate financial success or cash out compared to the people who conceived the rocket ship in the first place.
Yeah. And it's not, I also just want to emphasize here, it's not that this was like a particularly bad or inhumane, you know, company or set of labor relations or something. What they were doing was structurally, in some ways, as I mentioned, like kind of unique, this idea of like hiring long-term freelancers on a digital labor platform, but ultimately very similar to the kinds of offshoring and outsourcing relations that are really prevalent throughout the tech industry and far beyond the tech industry as well. In a lot of cases, you know, and I get into this in the book, that in a lot of cases, you might argue that actually, in some ways, these were humane, relatively humane labor arrangements. There are a lot of ways that especially workers in the Philippines felt that they benefited from their work as contractors for All Done. I'm not trying to tell a story where I think there's villains here and heroes, and the idea isn't to expose sort of malpractice within a particular company. It's really to just talk about, well, what are the structural conditions and economic incentives that set this whole thing in motion, right? That create the incentives for people to make the decisions that they make all the way down the chain. And ultimately, and to me, more interestingly, are there ways that we might actually reconfigure some of those economic structures and financial incentives and, you know, try to envision ways to do innovation that, you know, are not just designed to funnel almost all of the rewards to the people at the top, but actually to kind of share and spread those rewards more broadly to a greater array of stakeholders.
All right, this is a great transition, because on page 226, you ask a really important question, which is, do we need more hyper-exploitative Silicon Valleys in the world? Companies that tend to reward super wealthy investors, make workers' lives more precarious, and make the internet a worse place to be. And on the next page, you write, the ideas that are best for capital markets are not necessarily those that are best for societies. So how would you like to see innovation reorganized so that the benefits of change are distributed more equitably?
So I think that the tech industry, as I mentioned, is all about experimentation, right? Like, oh, let's try something new. Let's see what ideas can we throw out there and see what grows, right? I think there's been remarkably little experimentation when it comes to trying out new ownership structures for tech companies, new ways to fund tech companies and to think about how we can support them. So I talk about a few examples in the book of alternatives to the venture capital funding model. I'm not saying that these are the be-all end-all, but I do think it's really interesting to take a look at the landscape that's out there and try and figure out, are there other things we could promote that might kind of diminish the influence of this very winner-take-all model and perhaps benefit more people? One of the examples I give is based on a fantastic book by my colleague, Jessa Lingle, who's at Annenberg School here at Penn. And she wrote this book, An Internet for the People, that's about Craigslist, which, as you know, probably most listeners know, this online classified ad site that has barely changed for decades. You know, it's still super lo-fi. It's not harvesting user data to sell to advertisers. It's not constantly experimenting to maximize user engagement. It just does its job. And part of what she writes about in the book is that the founder, Craig Newmark, is this very web 1.0 guy who really believes still in the ethos of an open internet. And the only people who Craigslist charges to use the platform are employers who put up job posts and people who are listing housing, real estate, you know, like generally people who own housing or you know, real estate managers or things like that. And it's generally free for everyone else. And so it turns out Craigslist is a privately owned company. It basically, aside from a little blip, has not had outside investors who then sort of are able to put their thumb on the scale and insist that the company maximize growth for their own benefit, right? Obviously, it's very hard to build a privately owned tech company and to grow it as big as Craigslist grew, but it's sort of, it's an example out there of what you can do with private funding when you can balance sort of the profit motive with the more public service ethos, right? Obviously, nonprofit tech companies are already doing this. Mozilla, which runs Firefox, Wikipedia is a famous example. I also really like an example in Mary Gray and Siddharth Suri's book, Ghost Work, which is about a platform called Amara that lets people upload videos and then pay workers to caption those videos or translate them into other languages. They write about how these workers make 15 bucks an hour and have fairly decent working conditions compared to other online digital labor platforms, and how, you know, part of the reason they're able to do this is, of course, they don't have investors to please. They don't have to show that they're able to, you know, grow as fast as possible or reduce labor costs as much as possible, things like that. Another model that's been getting a lot of attention recently, Trevor Schultz has a new book about this, and some of his colleagues and many others have written about it as well, is platform cooperatives. And so these are digital platforms that are actually owned and operated by the people who rely on them for work. An example that is often touted here is a platform called Up and Go, which is for house cleaners in New York City. And I think it was a platform that there's sort of a local cooperative business that then was able to kind of meld this digital platform onto it. And, you know, instead of taking the money that comes in for the house cleaning jobs and siphoning it up to investing in new features that could grow the platform so it can achieve global domination or something like that, 95% of the money that comes in just goes to the workers who did the job, right? And the other 5% supports the operation of the platform. And so again, just a different kind of model for how a tech company is owned that really opens up different possibilities for how the rewards get distributed. And so I think, again, just going back to what I said at the beginning, we should be thinking more about, well, how do we support experiments like these if we're interested in technology innovation being something that benefits the many rather than the few?
I think I want to mention one more thing on this. You do talk about how tech entrepreneur companies and the VC ecosystem is part of the financialization of the economy, which I take to mean, and correct me if I'm mistaken on this, basically extracting value from existing forms of exchange and maybe not necessarily adding a lot of additional value. There's another use of the term value. Now we're on our Marx question here, I guess. And really hoovering up a great portion of the profits, basically, in distinction to Up and Go and these other worker-owned cooperative organizations. What I like about a part of your book is you basically say, all done, reinvented the yellow pages. Which, if you think about it like that, there's lots of tech companies that reinvent things that were already in existence. You know, basically Yelp sort of formalized and opened up recommendations for restaurants and other kinds of things that you might have from the, like, let's say you moved to a new place or a new job and you talk to your colleagues, like, where should I go to, like, which dentists are good and which...
Or the Zagat Guide.
Or the Zagat Guide or Michelin or whatever. Yeah. And so the rhetoric of innovation is super interesting here, because to what extent does All Done or Yelp, are these innovative, or are they, in addition to being, you know, a change, are they ways that holders of capital can extract and create more capital on the basis of, in Yelp's case, like, oftentimes consumer driven behavior, right?
Yeah. I mean, my answer would probably be yes and no. You know, it's like innovation, if we think of it as sort of the innovation, it often involves sort of repurposing one idea, bringing it into another domain, putting some sort of new spin on it. There is something about these digital platforms that is innovative, right? That introduces a new level of convenience that allows for a certain degree of ease in finding information, sorting information, There are some things that are new here, but is it sort of disrupting an industry and changing the world in the way that Silicon Valley is often imagined? Well, no. I mean, it's very much not disrupting our socioeconomic status quo. And in fact, as you know, as you've suggested, you could argue that really what platforms like this are doing are providing investment vehicles for wealthy investors and the wealthy individuals and institutions, you know, that participate in VC funds, providing opportunities for them to extract value from local commerce, right? So bringing, you know, opportunities to bring in bigger and bigger players into small markets and allow them to profit from the activity, you know, you and your house cleaner might have engaged in, you know, without an intermediary before. Mm-hmm. Or maybe your house cleaner used to pay the Yellow Pages once a year, but didn't have to pay every time they were contacting every client or something like that. So I think that I'm on board with what you're suggesting here. I think there is something going on where, you know, part of the picture of innovation seems to be creating innovative ways to bring the tentacles of finance deeper and deeper into our everyday lives and to bring it places where it didn't have a foothold before, right? And mm-hmm. private equity is doing the same thing. So VC is actually, it's actually sort of a form of private equity financing, but what we often call private equity, where private investors go out and they purchase established firms, which is different from VC, which purchases kind of like very new companies. But private equity is also going into more and more places, extracting mm-hmm. wealth for investors that didn't used to be for big investors, right? So like they're rolling up medical practices. My doctor, I forget if it's my doctor or another doctor I looked up recently, but many doctors are now part of practices that are owned by these PE consortiums, right? PE is in agriculture. PE is in housing. It's big in housing. You're going to see investors. That's part of what financialization is about, right? There's more and more investors involved in more and more social domains. And ultimately, when investors are sort of calling the shots, that means, of course, that they're going to want to see things that will maximize their chances of extracting returns, which can mean different things for different asset forms. It may look different in VC than it looks in PE, right? If PE buys a company that has a factory, they might say, okay, we want you to cut wages and benefits for your workers so that, you know, this thing gets more efficient. If VC buys a stake in a startup, they might not care about efficiency at all. What they care is like, are you able to just be really reckless and throw everything you've got at making this company grow as fast as possible? So I guess that's just sort of a side note. And something I've been writing about recently is that even when we say finance, financialization, and financial actors are everywhere, it's still important to acknowledge that they might have different motives, different ways of achieving returns, depending on what kind of asset it is that we're talking about.
I'm glad you mentioned the tentacles metaphor, because that was exactly mm-hmm. what I was thinking. And the housing case for private equity is also the one that I was thinking of. But basically, it's often inserting additional layers of people who need to be paid or have a financial stake in the outcomes here. And you can imagine that can cause, essentially, there's like inefficiencies in rents, right, that people extract and that entities extract from like everyday folks who like go to work and get a wage for their job, which makes life just that much more challenging for them. All right, but I want to ask two questions as we kind of close out at least this portion before we get to banter, because I'm excited about that. But I want to ask about access and entering and leaving the field. So you were with All Done for 19 months of intensive field work. You traveled to the Philippines and to Las Vegas. As we mentioned, there were some social events and parties, and sounds like there were some interesting times in the Philippines, other places.
Yeah.
So how did you manage your dual relationship as both an employee and ethnographer while at All Done?
It was thrilling. It was exhausting. It was challenging. I mean, I think any ethnographer who has found themselves in sort of a situation where they become really deeply embedded in the activities of an organization have probably had a similar set of experiences. I sort of had a few touchstones in terms of how I thought about my presence and managing my own presence in the field that were rooted in both sort of theories developed by other ethnographers and also maybe just sort of my common sense and my sense of personal ethics. So there's a lot of dilemmas that ethnographers face when they become deeply embedded in a field site. And you have to be thoughtful and do your best around all these dilemmas. There's three or four of them that I write about in the book that I'm actually sort of expanding on in an article that's about this strange thing that happened to me of becoming a middle manager while I was doing field work, which is very uncommon to say the least. But one of the issues that I thought about a lot was what's known as reactivity, right? How do you know that the things you're observing are not phenomena that you yourself are generating, right? Of course, I'm a student of Michael Burovoy and, you know, of the extended case method. And for me, you know, reactivity is certainly something to be aware of. It's something that in some senses I tried to minimize, but I also, you know, sort of accepted that it would be impossible to eliminate myself and my vantage point from the field. And in fact, that putting myself in this position really afforded me a set of insights that would have been impossible to achieve if I had tried to kind of hold myself back as a more marginal member of the organization, like an unpaid intern, for instance, which is how it started. So sometimes I tried to take advantage of my reactivity and, you know, see actually how people would respond to different things I might say. Sometimes I tried to minimize it, like as someone who was, you know, sort of overseeing some of these divisions of remote workers, I frequently talked with some of the leaders of those teams. And I would basically try to be careful to try and understand what they thought of a situation before I gave my opinion. And to me, this was just a way, both, I think, for me to do my, in a sense, my job better in the field, but also, I think, a really important way to actually elicit members of the organization's genuine understanding of what was going on, rather than, you know, potentially the threat that they would just want to repeat what I had said, maybe if they thought that that would put them in better stead with leadership or something like that. Of course, there's no state of the field in which, like, maybe if my boss had still been managing these teams, maybe he actually would have just told them what he thought and not listened to them. There's no kind of like neutral state of the field that we can compare this to. Right. But that's sort of how I tried to navigate reactivity. Also, there were often times, as there are for a lot of ethnographers, where my role as a researcher, my role as a participant could conflict with each other. I talk about some examples like where this really tough example where one of the contractors in Las Vegas was getting fired and she sort of wanted to talk to me and go over her boss's head and go straight to me with her grievances. And I decided, sort of as exciting as that would be for my research, you know, to hear from this woman who had this negative experience with the company and had just been fired, it would have put me in a position that I think, like, not only my supervisor would have wondered, like, well, why are you wasting your time on this thing that I don't view as part of your purview? But then also would have made things a lot harder for Carol, who was the supervisor on that team, would have made it harder for her if people were going over her head to me. So, you know, I kind of tried to stay in my lane as much as I could and to not do things to get research access that felt like they would have not been congruent with my role in the field. also, we already talked about this, like there's just the irreconcilable dilemma when you're holding a position of relative power in the field. On the one hand, you're going to be complicit with things that, you know, maybe are not so great about what's happening in the field. On the other hand, I did feel an obligation to try to improve things as much as I could for the people who I was working with. And, you know, we talked about how that was not often successful, unfortunately, which is also, by the way, a common experience for ethnographers. Karen Ho writes about something similar in her book Liquidated, where she was working at an investment bank on Wall Street, and she was supposed to write up a report about like how they could cut costs in the back office. And her report, you know, basically said they shouldn't do that. And from what I remember, I'm pretty sure the company said, well, we're not going to listen to you. Finally, one last thing I'll talk about, which to me was not a big concern, but some people have expressed this concern to me, is this idea that if you take on a paid role in an organization, then there's this risk of bias. Like you're not going to want to say something critical about the organization or tell all of what you saw because of the norm of reciprocity. You'll feel like you sort of owe them. But again, as a student of Burovoy who, you know, conducted famous ethnographers of workplaces, and many of his other students, Jeff Salaz, Rachel Sherman, folks who did paid work, learned a lot from getting paid, you know, learned a lot about, for instance, how work games are structured in a factory, in a luxury hotel, in a casino, and really embodied those experiences and came to understand them in a way that they couldn't have if they hadn't done the work for pay. I think that's so important. And of course, these were also all really critical ethnographies of capitalism writ large. So I definitely feel like I fit in that tradition and that I learned so much from actually holding this tiny set of stock options. I learned so much about what it felt like to get wrapped up in this world of feverish speculation, where it seems like anything is possible. And if things keep going this way, your life could change forever. And, you know, I mean, I write in the book about just the seduction of this environment and how I found myself experiencing an existential crisis where I really didn't know whether I would go back to grad school and finish my degree or stay at Aldan, as everyone was telling me, everyone in the company was telling me I should stay. And they were saying, tell us what you want, name your price, and, you know, we'd love to keep you here. You know, experiencing that level of seduction firsthand really helped me understand, like, if these imagined futures are affecting me at such a deep level, and I had no doubt that, you know, my colleagues were equally, if not probably much more so, wrapped up in sort of this feverish speculation about what this company's growth could mean for them and could mean for their futures.
That's great. I think it also leads me to my last question about your book and what's happened after you left Aldan. You have stayed in touch with some of the people there after you formally left the field. What have those who stayed with the company told you about how things are going since Aldan really hit it big and is now valued in the billions of dollars? And what about those who left?
This is interesting. I don't have really any ongoing contacts with people who are still there. My view of sort of the post-unicorn Aldan, where the valuation is over $1 billion, is very limited. You know, it's like second or third hand things that I've heard. What I know is pretty much what you would expect. And it's been interesting watching this company for so long because I've seen how it just rides these waves in VC funding. So, you know, when I got there, which was a long time ago, this book has been a long time coming. I got there in you know, the early 20-teens in 2012. And this was a time when kind of the second startup boom was really just kind of coming into its own in San Francisco. There's a lot of money flowing into startups, and that continued for quite a while. But there, you know, there are times where there'd be kind of a year or two when things are really big and they're racing like multiple rounds in a year. And then there would be times when the market kind of dries up a little bit and there's no fundraising for a while. The biggest kind of example of this happened more recently during COVID, where at first, you remember, like, the economy just tanked. And for Aldun, you know, as with a lot of tech companies, there were layoffs right away when kind of the economy shut down. And there was a lot of fear because, you know, this is a company that basically exists to connect people who are buying and selling local services, which means a lot of in-person interaction, right? Mm-hmm. Which at the beginning of the pandemic, not necessarily a growth business. But it turned out a couple things kind of shifted very quickly. One was that everyone was staying at home and there were a ton of home improvement projects that had to get done even during the pandemic. And so this sector of Aldun's business exploded. You know, people wanted people to help them turn, you know, a bedroom into an office or a basement into an office or whatever it was, or we're spending more time at home. We bought a big TV and someone needs to mount our TV on the wall. Like, whatever it is, tons of home improvement projects. So business is actually surprisingly way up. And then, as you may recall, the tech industry just saw this massive boom led in part by, you know, the rise of Zoom, but also just all the time people were spending online. And again, like, this huge boom of VC money, and VC set records in 2020 and 2021 for the amount of money invested in tech companies. And so Aldun raised another round of funding during that last round. You know, it went very quickly from sort of a dire outlook to a lot of excitement. And I think the expectation that an IPO is coming soon. But then, of course, as we also know, that tech bubble burst about a year later, and the IPO market dried up and there just hasn't been a lot of action there. Now there's a lot of money going into generative AI, which is like the new wave of where VC money is going, not as much into kind of the old marketplace platforms. And so, you know, my understanding is that the company, you know, it's there, it continues to serve its function, but I don't think anybody knows, you know, if an IPO is coming or an acquisition is coming, or if it's going to turn into one of those zombies I mentioned before that, you know, can last a long time, has a bunch of money coming in, but ultimately its valuation is not going to increase in such a way that all those people who put money in the last round are going to be able to sell and make a profit. So, you know, the future is ambiguous. And I think based on what I've seen, I'm just watching the VC market, you know, and the IPO market. And I think when there's a lot of money sloshing around, especially when interest rates were low, then we're going to expect to see more money going into companies like this and more IPOs. And when interest rates get high and the money gets tighter, they're all kind of waiting it out and hoping that they'll be able to ride it to the next wave. And again, that's like, it's part of the financialization story. Like, right, everyone's kind of riding these waves of speculation, these speculative bubbles. And the value of the companies is often very loosely coupled at best to their profitability as an operation. What's important, again, is if people believe that someone down the line is going to pay more for a stake in this company than they originally paid. So it's really much more about, I think, these waves in the financial market than about what the company itself does.
Vibes.
Yeah, vibes.
Speculative vibes.
You got to have them.
Yeah. Okay. Let's transition to banter. We are talking on August 7th. I'm leaving for the ASA meeting tomorrow afternoon, which is in Montreal this year. Very much looking forward to it. I know you're coming up, and so it should be a good conference as usual. One of the perennial questions we have on the annex is, where else should ASA go? We've gone recently to Philadelphia, of course, and Chicago and San Francisco. And did I mention New York City and other deeper cuts, Las Vegas, which is a memorable
I heard time. About that one. I didn't make it there, but supposedly Very interesting. Sociologically, of course.
Yes, sociologically very interesting for on multiple levels, but yeah, we won't go into it here. But where else should ASA go, Benjamin?
I'm a traditionalist. I was really disappointed when ASA got moved to Chicago for next year because it was originally scheduled for San Francisco, which is a standby. But, you know, I'm a Berkeley grad and I did my field work, as we've discussed out there. Yeah, I really wanted to go back. I loved when we were chatting about this before recording. I loved the Vancouver idea because I know you mentioned one of your prior guests had suggested Vancouver, other cities in Canada. But I remember when I was a grad student, you know, I was fortunate to be at a place like Berkeley that it's not the most well-resourced institution, but it's relatively well-resourced. And I remember applying to the SSHA conference, Social Science History Association. Yeah. Not really my wheelhouse. It was a great conference, great people, but not my wheelhouse. But I applied because it was in Vancouver and because I was eligible for a travel grant as a grad student for international travel.
Sure.
And so, you know, I did like a day at the conference and I spent a day just wandering around the city. I remember especially Stanley Park. Have you been to Vancouver?
I have not, but I would love to go.
Okay,
someone
yeah.
should sponsor me.
Yeah, I mean, Stanley Park is just this gorgeous spot that's right on the water. And I remember walking all around the perimeter and just being like, it took my breath away. So I'm a huge supporter of the Vancouver idea. You know, a lot of people also advocate for sort of smaller, more affordable cities. I would have no problem with that either. Like, I've never been to Cleveland. I'd check it out. Why not? I'm down. I'm open.
Yeah, I've never been to Cleveland, but here's what I will say about San Francisco. And as the treasurer of the Pacific Sociological Association, I feel like I have to put a plug in for the 2025 PSA annual meeting, which will be in San Francisco in late March. So just for the record,
there you go.
My PSA friends, and for people who I'll see in Montreal, I will be hyping the PSA meeting in March in 2025 at the Park 55 Hotel in San Francisco.
Wait, can we do a little hot goss on this?
Sure.
So I heard that ASA 2025 was moved from San Francisco because the venue went bankrupt. Did you hear this? And I thought
that
ASA often did it, at least in part, at the Park 55, but I think they used to do multiple, like a multiple location conference. So maybe it was one of the other ones.
They've done multiple. I believe Park 55 has been a venue in addition to Hilton, which I believe it, like, there's like a long-term contract, but please don't hold me to that, ASA council members who may or may not listen to the show. But in any case, PSA will be in San Francisco. It looks to be a fabulous conference, and everyone should come because it's a good space. It's a good space for early queer researchers. There's a very robust undergraduate program, which is somewhat unusual for sociology conferences. And of course, there are faculty members from all types of institutions who are there. Okay, we're going to have to stop talking about PSA. And just wanted to thank you so much, Benjamin, for your book and for the time you spent helping us understand the world of startups, venture capital, and inequality in our economy these days.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Dan. And thanks for actually reading the book. As I've mentioned to you, many podcast hosts do not. So I really appreciate that because your questions were really interesting. And I really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, it's definitely my pleasure to engage with your book. I do read the books that we talk about or I talk about here on the Annex. And so appreciate it so much, Benjamin. You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Thanks to our guest, Benjamin Shostakovsky, to Joe Cohen, the director of the Queen's Podcast Lab, and to our editors. Music by Lena Orsa.